I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, my guest is Donald Hall, one of the most important and well-known poets in the English language. And we're going to talk about his latest book, which is A Carnival of Losses, Notes Nearing 90. This is not the first time I've had Donald Hall on the show. The first time, he was in his mid to late 80s, retired, living on his family farm where he grew up as a child. And he told me during that interview that this was probably going to be his last book. He didn't think he would be around to write another one. He even told me about a poetry reading he did where he got a standing ovation, and it occurred to him that the audience wasn't giving him that ovation because they thought it was a great reading, but rather because they thought they would never see him again, that it would be his last reading. I loved the conversation with him. I felt very comfortable with him immediately. He's a very generous man. In spite of his stature as a great American poet, he was very easy to talk to. And when we said goodbye, he was certain it would be the goodbye forever. But he was wrong. A few years later, he came out with another book, Essays After 80, in which he reflected a lot on his life as a poet, his marriage to Jane Kenyon, whom he lost to cancer when she was very young. She was in her 40s. A fantastic book, and we had another great conversation. We talked about aging. I'm getting old, and like him, I want to write all the way until my 80s and 90s. I even want to write when I'm 100. God gives us 120 years to live. It's in the Bible. Check it out. And I plan on living all 120 of my years writing. So he's a very good role model for a writer. He writes about 20 to 25 letters a day right now, which is amazing if you think about it. And I'm sure it's what keeps his brain so young. So anyway, after our conversations on Essays After 80, we said goodbye. And again, he was certain that it would be the last time we talked and it would be the last book he would write. But no, he was wrong again. Today, we're going to talk about his new book, A Carnival of Losses, Notes Nearing 90. He's going to be 90 years old in a few months. I'm amazed that he's still writing with such poignancy and such precision. And I'm almost certain that at the end of this interview or somewhere in this interview, he's going to say this will be his last book. But I don't think so. Don't forget the Bible. 120 years, Donald Hall. I can't wait to see his book, Happenings at 100. He's a wonderful poet, and we have great conversations. So stick around and listen to my talk with the great American poet, Donald Hall. Donald Hall is one of the major American poets of our time, and actually a few generations before our time. He is author of too many books to count, although I think the last count there was over 50. He has written children's books, biographies, memoirs, essays, and many, many volumes of poetry. He was one of the very first poetry editors of the Paris Review. He was a U.S. Poet Laureate, and I'm not going to go into it too much because everybody knows Donald Hall. Donald Hall, welcome back to Words on a Wire.
Glad to be here.
And you know, this is the third time you've been on the show, and
yes.
I think that this one is going to go bacterial.
Why? Good for you. I'm glad.
That's a term you use where everyone else uses viral. You say it goes bacterial.
I know.
That's fantastic.
I know. I enjoyed that. It was a subdued backing, but it was still a backing.
Yeah, I'm going to start using that. So you have over 50 books across many genres. You have children's literature, biography, memoir, essays, many, many books of poems. A few years ago, you came out with Essays at 80, and now you come out with a brand new book, A Carnival of Losses, Notes Nearing 90. Are you ever going to slow down?
Yes. I think I just have. I doubt there'll be anything else. Notes After 90 will be out in July.
Right.
And I turned 90 in September. And actually, lately, I've been troubled by a great deal of fatigue.
Uh-huh.
Hard for me to get things done. I keep lying now. What do I expect pushing 90, you know?
Right.
Of course, I'd rather keep going, but I can't really expect to be writing books at 110.
Your writing process, I imagine, has changed over the years.
Oh, yeah.
And so with this book of essays and these memories, some of them are incredibly short, some of them are a little longer. What was your writing process like?
Well, the main difference was that I had to do everything many, many times, every page. And that never used to be true. I've really done a lot more than 50 books, believe it or not. But I've made my living by my writing since 1975. I did a lot of publication before then, but then I quit teaching at the University of Michigan and moved with my wife, Jane Kenyon, to this whole family place in New Hampshire that my great-grandfather moved into in 1865. I'd spent my summers here with my grandparents, and it had always been my favorite place in the world. And I quit teaching with my fingers crossed. And I could make a living, you know.
Right.
Back then, I did book reviews for the New York Times and all sorts of things and places. And I found out that Gertrude Stein was a great lover of the Ford cars. Mm-hmm. So I wrote a tiny piece for the Ford Times about Gertrude Stein and her Ford cars. And I think maybe it cost $500 for it.
Wow.
That's... I worked for Yankee magazine and so on. Well, when I wrote, say, a book review for the Times or page two for the old book review, I would usually do it in 3 days. I have friends in the newspaper business who have to do everything in one draft, you know. But I would need to go over 3 times. But as I've gotten older, it takes many, many more. I make so many mistakes, or the words I miss.
Right.
I put in, you know, a dull verb like move and a dull adverb like move quickly. And if I keep it around long enough, the two words disappear and are replaced by one lively verb. I don't want to try to make up an example spur of the moment. It would be hard for you to believe this, but there were some pages of this new book of which I had 100 copies. 100 versions. Yeah.
Well, that doesn't sound so different from your past, because you're kind of famous for revising a single poem for years and years until you get it right.
Yeah. I always had to do that with poems, but not so much with prose.
Right.
The first prose book, which was called String Too Short to Be Saved, is still in print after so many years. When I began it, I'd never written anything like it before. It was a memoir of summers here with my grandparents when I was 12, 13 years old. And the first draft, the first chapter, I remember it took me 19 times. And back then, that seemed like a hell of a lot of times. But at the end of the book, I learned how to write it, and I think every chapter, which I did 3 times only to get it done.
Wow. You know, I'm wondering, you know, I only have 5 books out and I write very slowly. And I know people who have a lot of books. I mean, you probably are the person that has more than anybody I've ever met. But with all those books, I'm wondering, when one of them goes out of print, is there a sadness involved? Or is it just like, well, I got so many other books, who cares?
Well, there's some sadness. There's one book, a guy named Christian Wyman, a poet, teaches at Yale now, which is dedicated to me. And in that book, he mentions one book of mine, which is gone out of print, and laments it. And back in 1978, I wrote a book called Remembering Poets, which was my own reminiscences of acquaintance with old Dylan Thomas and Robert Frost and T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound, the old guys of generation before me. And it did very well, printed a couple of times. And then later I got to know other poets, I knew Marianne Moore, that same generation, very well. And I wrote more. And I rewrote some of those from the first book and published a book which was reprinted and new, and it never did anything. But the guy who just wrote the book dedicated to me said it's out of print and it's a disgrace. I'm hoping to try to take that out of this book and sell it again to somebody else. But I've had lots of books which have gone out of print and then come back.
Right.
And I've also had, you know, I did a book of short stories, and then quite a few years later, I did another one in which I reprinted most of them, rewrote them some, and added new ones. And I did that with essays about poetry also. Mm-hmm. And there are a whole lot of books in print right now.
Yeah.
I can't remember how many.
I don't think anyone can remember how many. There's so many of them. You know, you published a poem about a man who would fill up his ox cart with goods and go to another town, and he would sell the goods, and then he would sell the cart, and then he would sell the ox. And that struck you as kind of beautiful. And so you wrote a poem about it, but you also wrote a very successful children's book about it. And it was translated into Japanese. It was translated into so many different languages. And that book, was it your, perhaps, the most successful, financially speaking, book you've ever written?
Probably. It still sells lots of copies in English, but it was a huge seller in Japan. Later in South Korea, and now, over the last few years, in China. Jane and I went over to Japan one time, late in the 80s, sent by the State Department. In the Cold War, poets got sent out a lot to read. And I went to Japan, and I read it aloud in English, and my host read it aloud in Japanese. But it has been amazing. It won the Caldecott to begin with. And my goodness, it had been published, it came out, I think, in December of the Viking Press, and the first printing had been 20,000 copies, which I thought was a hell of a lot of copies. And in January, word got around that it had won the prize, and it was not yet publicly announced, but the Viking Press republished it in an edition of 80,000 copies.
Wow.
With the Caldecott medal later stuck on the front of it. And good, I have no idea how many copies it has sold now. But I know that it's sold a hell of a lot in the Orient especially. Nobody knows why.
You know, it's a beautiful story, and it's still...
I was very lucky in my illustrator, Barbara Cooney, who is absolutely marvelous.
Yeah, and the book is still in print, and it's still a bestseller. I mean, I imagine you still get royalty checks for that book.
Oh, absolutely. Several every year. A couple from China, at least, and I know one from the United States comes in every year. But, there's going to be a new printing of it in America shortly, because it's the 40th anniversary.
Wow.
And nobody ever told me. I'm sure the Viking Press thinks I'm dead, you know. I don't know. But somebody who is, I can't remember her name, but she's famous in the world of children's books, and she's doing an introduction to it. It's coming out yet again. And, I'm about to become a great-grandfather.
Oh, congratulations.
First time.
Wow.
And, of course, my granddaughter knows the book very well. It came out long before she was born. But I will make sure that there's a copy there.
You know, I'm talking to Donald Hall, whose latest book is A Carnival of Losses, Notes Nearing 90. And just a few minutes ago, you were talking about a children's book writer, and you said, I can't remember her name. And apparently, all your life, you and your wife, Jane Kenyon, had trouble remembering names.
Absolutely. I've heard about it in the new book. Yeah. It gets much worse when you're 80s, you know.
Right. But I was wondering, you know, as you approach 90, and you write these really wonderfully funny essays in this book about losing your teeth and about... naps and all these things. But I'm wondering, I remember being a young man and I would walk into a room and I would forget why I walked into it. And and now when I walk into a room and I forget why I walked into it, I think, oh my gosh, I'm getting old. And I'm wondering how you distinguish those things that you used to always forget and then those things that you forget now because of your aging.
Well, if anybody's with me, they take one look at me and they're surprised that I remember anything.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, and, you know, you write this essay about how a drugstore, it wasn't like the drugstores we have now, like the CVS or the, you know, the Rite Aid or the Walgreens, they actually, that was the place for you to get books, where people bought books, and including poetry books.
Yeah, it was really true.
That's how you got exposed to poetry, which is really interesting. I'm wondering now where poetry is really, hard copies of poetry aren't really very easy to get now. A lot of people access poetry online, and I'm wondering what kind of effect that has had on the way that we read poetry and poetry's place in our culture.
I've seen an extraordinarily strange development, which people find it hard to believe. When I was in college, my senior year, there were poets who had become famous. None of us knew we would ever publish a book.
Oh, right.
But we included John Ashbery and Frank O'Hara and Adrienne Rich and Robert Bly and Kenneth Koch and Donald Princeton at the same time. W.S. Merwin and Galway Canal. And the market for poetry was terribly tiny at the time, and it is instantly more now. There are many more poets in the United States. There are more poetry magazines. There are more books published in a year and more books sold in a year, but it's a very narrow group. There was, back in the early day, there was something called the general reader. You never hear that phrase anymore. People who are into poetry are often into it almost exclusively, and everybody else never touches it.
Right, right. That's
and
true.
And this has been a considerable change over the last 70 years. Goodness me, 70 years ago. I can't believe I'm saying that. It's when I was in college.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, once the publishing industry began to shrink in New York, the trade presses began to shrink, a kind of a unexpected result is that the poetry world expanded so much with these independent presses. A couple of grad students get together and they start a publishing company so they can publish their friends and poets that they admire.
Yeah.
And so there's like so much poetry out there right now.
I still get it in the mail all the time. And I don't have the strength to read it all anymore, you know. I get too tired.
Yeah. You know, when I started this show, you know, I thought, well, I'm going to, you know, new books of poems. I'm gonna read them. I'm going to get all these new poets on my show. But my gosh, there's so many books coming out that I'd have to like spend 2 minutes on each book.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is, you know, I'm thinking how many of these poets are going to be around after they die? Because one of the realities of the poetry world today is if you get a book published, you need to go out there and sell it almost like a door-to-door salesman. I mean, you really need to do that. And you were talking about how these great anthologies, you would find them in drugstores with these wonderful poets.
Oscar Williams, yeah.
There was one American poetry anthology that you referred to, and you says now, when you look through the table of contents, there's only T.S. Eliot that's known. All the rest of the poets have been forgotten.
Yep. And I keep telling everybody that I know I will be forgotten. And, of course, you always hope that somebody in the future will find you sometime and be in an anthology. But yes, I remember my youth and fairly famous names in my youth. Eliot was supreme, but there was Wallace Stevens up in Hartford, Connecticut. And he was in his 60s or 70s, you know, and there he was publishing marvelous stuff. He still remembered to a degree. He still taught in colleges, as is Eliot and so on. And that helps it. If you get on the teaching list, you may be survived. But there are all sorts of poets that I remember were fairly well known in my time who were just absolute blanks. And many of the people printed in anthologies.
Yeah. You know, in this book, you make some references to, you know, your younger days when you were invited to like 6 cocktail parties a week. And there was a lot of, you know, readings, and after readings, there were receptions and there were drinks. And I'm wondering, that lifestyle that you used to have as a young man, where you would party a lot and you would flirt and you would, you know, you just, you know, had a great time with, you know, hanging out with other poets. I'm wondering, do you go to parties now? Do you drink now? Do you socialize the way you used to?
I haven't been to a party in how many years? I have to push a rollator to get around. I can't walk by myself. I walk pushing my rollator. I take care of myself. I live alone most of the time. But I can't drive. Mm-hmm. At the moment, if I could drive, I find it hard to leave without being to parties. I would really better be alone or be with one person. Mm-hmm. I do have a lady friend. And I see her a couple of days a week. And,
that's nice.
Yeah. When I talk about 6 parties a week, I'm talking about Ann Arbor, the university town, and actually within a first marriage, and when Jane and I got married, we got married there and lived 3 years there, but we cut down on parties.
Right.
We did not want to go to them. So much we bothered each other and reading books and so on. And then when we came here, I worked somewhere that in New Hampshire, there's a constitutional amendment against cocktail parties. I mean, I've been to parties in New Hampshire, but not very many and not for years. We lived in the metropolis. And there was a cocktail party culture. And here, I live in a house originally built in 1803, and I can see only one house from it.
Wow.
And I own it, and it's where my amanuensis lives. And there are several houses within a mile, but I live right in the country. And I live in a kind of rural quietness and the beauty of the landscape. It's a totally different world from the university world.
Do you miss those days?
No. Not really. I mean, you know, I miss certain friends and occasions, but I moved here, and Jane became a first-rate poet because we moved here, and it was almost forced upon her. She's a superb poet. She died young, from reading me. I was 19 years older, and we almost didn't get married because we knew that she would be a widow for so long.
You know, it sounds like, you know, you have the farmhouse. There's not a lot of neighbors around. It's quiet. Sounds like it'd be a great place to throw a party. If you ever decide to do that, I want to go. That would be off the wall.
Okay, I'll invite you. Just around the corner from El Paso.
Yeah. I'm interested right now for a novel I'm working on, I'm interested in lay neuroscience and how the brain works. And one of the things that I stumbled upon is how to care for an aging brain. And I'm trying to do these things because I know that as a writer, I want to have the clarity at 90 that you have now? That I want your clarity. It's amazing that you're still able to write these beautiful essays and your play with language and your humor and the poignancy of your essays. It just blows me away. And I'm wondering.
I'm very lucky. I thank you so much for those words. As you know, it's hard work, but I love it.
Well, you write 15 letters a day. You correspond with 15 different people. Oh, by the way, I'm going to suggest that those 15 letters a day could make your next book.
I think that my archive has something like 350 or 400,000
wow.
Letters. It's at the University of New Hampshire. Amazing. My mother and my grandmother were both great letter writers, and I have followed from them since I was a little kid. Up here, I found letters I wrote to my grandparents. And in the beginning, when I was just could first write, you know,
right.
Hardly for calling them letters, but I wanted to do what my mother did, which was to write her sisters every day. So
right. And you write letters. You don't write emails. You write letters.
Some of them take the form of emails.
Okay.
I do not have a computer, and I mentioned the house with my assistant in it, and she has a computer.
Oh, okay.
And so often I write emails, but I dictate them, and I read them over and correct them and give them to her. It's delivered over the air. But to me, it's a piece of paper that as I finish it and as I read it. So I think of them as letters.
According to the Bible, we are given 120 years, so you still have a long time to go before you leave us. But I'm wondering, as you approach 90 and as you have this really beautiful life, I mean, my God, I want your lifestyle. I love the idea that you stay at home, you write letters, you read, but I'm wondering where you are now and with all the chances you've had to reflect and all the experience that you've had, what would you, if you were to be able to confront Donald Hall at 20, what would your advice be? What was the number one thing you would advise Donald Hall at 20?
About that, because I am really at 20. I believe I can say that I wanted to make my life as a writer. I think that maybe at 20, I wanted to write poems all my life and support myself by writing fiction. Well, I haven't done that, but I have done something like what I wanted to do, and I don't mean that I haven't done stupid things and made mistakes. I'd rather not talk about that.
Yes, I know the worst thing you've ever done. It's in the book.
I just thought about that. I had a great many amusing memories for this book we're speaking of. Bits and pieces of my life all over the place.
Yeah.
But also I had the memories of things where I'd been stupid or callous or and sad memories, of course. Death of my father so young and so on. My father died just after he turned 52, and my mother lived to be almost 91. She was 1 month south of 91. I knew that I was an only child. And that may be some of my pleasure in solitude. I never had siblings. By this point, I think we've talked about as much as we were supposed to, and I notice that I am getting tired.
Okay, yeah, well, our time is up. But thank you for joining us again on Words on a Wire. The name of the book is A Carnival of Losses, Notes Nearing 90, coming out in July 2018. Donald Hall, I can't wait to talk to you when you publish your next book. Please keep us in mind.
I have to get to work on it. Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
I'd like to thank my guest, Donald Hall, for joining me on another edition of Words on a Wire, and I look forward to his next book, which I know he will write, and I know I will get a copy and talk to him again. I'd like to thank our producer, Lauren Terrazas, and thank you for listening. I'm Daniel Chacon. See you on another edition of Words on a Wire.